Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
What does Hezbollah want? Why is Kenya getting involved in Haiti?
What can the world's biggest iceberg tell us?
The Inquiry. One big question.
Can we trust Google?
Four expert witnesses.
Time for our second expert witness.
And an answer.
What will be the solution?
Explore the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world with The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Leanna Byrne, and on this edition, how concerned should we be about Europe's economy? The European Central Bank has cut interest rates for the third time in a year. We'll hear from businesses across the bloc about how they're feeling.
It's quite shaky, I can say, especially in the sector which is tied to public budgets. We see a downturn in a number of different areas that we operate in, especially in larger European economies.
And the economics of water. A report suggests that mismanagement, destructive land use and climate change are putting unprecedented stress on the global water cycle, and that could send the global economy down the sink. And finally, are you a new Netflix subscriber? Its latest result says there's 5 million more of you. So tell me, what's got you signed up and what's your favourite show? You can contact us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note on 0044 330 678 3033, or you can email us at any time on world.business@bbc.co.uk. But let's start with developments in Europe. The European Central Bank has cut interest rates to 3.25%. It's the first back-to-back rate cut since the euro crisis of 2011. And this happened as the ECB is trying to prevent a significant slowdown in the eurozone's economy. President Christine Lagarde said a surprising drop in inflation prompted the cut, which is aimed at ensuring a soft landing for the bloc's economic challenges. And here on World Business Report, we wanted to get under the hood of the European economy and find out what's really going on. Why is Europe's economy struggling? Where is that growth that people are hoping for? And what are the challenges facing people running businesses across the continent? Now, in a couple of minutes, we'll hear from Karsten Bretzky, who's the global head of macro research at ING. But let's start by hearing from some of those business owners. We've asked people across a number of different sectors and countries, and we'll start in the East. Andreas runs a family beer brewery in Lithuania.
At this time, in Lithuania, the situation is quite stable. I can say salaries are growing step by step. Oh, prices also growing in the same level. So electricity prices, fuel prices are quite stable during last year. So there was no big increase, as renewable energy in Lithuania is growing quite fast. So we have stabilization, let's say, in this field. Fuel prices are also quite stable. Some taxes were increased, so some restaurants are closing, but pubs, bars is growing because people want to relax, want to have a good time. So from beer brewery perspective, we don't see any big difference during the last year. Maybe slightly grow, but naturally in wintertime, everything should be a little bit slowed down. And usually heating prices every year are growing, so we're expecting to have higher bills than last year. So this, I think, will slow down a little bit all the market. But after winter, everything should come back.
So some optimism, though concerns about the winter ahead from Andreas in Lithuania. Let's head to the south next, to Croatia.
Hello, everybody. My name is Ivan Franicevic. I am the CEO of a company called Rasco. We are a manufacturer of road maintenance equipment, and we are based in Croatia. Given that we operate all throughout Europe, we can give a pretty good perspective on how different markets are moving. And at the moment, it's quite shaky, I can say, especially in the sector which is tied to public budgets. We see a downturn in a number of different areas that we operate in, especially in larger European economies. Contrary to that, Central and Eastern European markets are doing quite well, which is a bit surprising. But what we do hope for the imminent future is that the ECB's interest rate easing is going to have a positive effect on the economy, especially the large economies such as Germany and France, and that also the European Union will ease up on the regulation that it has put in place and that is now basically choking the economy to a very large degree.
So that's a view from Croatia. Now let's head to west, to France, one of the biggest economies in Europe.
I'm Karine Mass. My company is located in Paris, and we offer custom-made realistic hair and wigs. And right now, the French economy is facing quite high inflation, which directly impacts consumers' purchasing power. In my sector, which combines luxury with handcrafted hair solution for aesthetic and medical needs, this is noticeable. So the cost of production, shipping cost also has increased, and certain taxes also. But the demand remains strong because my clients prioritize quality and comfort. So I try to believe that economic situation is driving some people towards more lasting solution, which helps me maintain a quite stable business despite the current situation.
And from Karine to last but definitely not least, let's head to Europe's westernmost coast. Miguel Campina runs a restaurant business in the holiday destination of the Algarve in Portugal.
Everything is going really well, very balanced. When we think that we cannot grow anymore, the businesses are still growing about 10% a year. The British, we have a fantastic relationship in terms of people enjoying the sunshine of the Algarve, the food. Mine and all my other colleagues of the hotels, restaurants, bars, resorts, we all trying to improve every year to offer the best. We had a growth of 2% of our economy in 2024 due to the tourism. The investment is also on a high level. This is due to the fact that we have a new government, a government that looks to the private sector and the companies. The only area that the inflation did not stop was obviously on the properties, because the Portuguese properties, especially in the south of Portugal, the Algarve, the demand is absolutely incredible. And I think for the next 4 years, with this government that we have in place at the moment, the companies will benefit. And if the companies benefit, the people will benefit. In the end of the day, the companies are the engine of the economy. At the moment, the unemployment rate is 6%, which is not very high for Portugal. And the economy is vibrant and the economy feels confident in the next 4 years.
So Miguel is pretty positive. So why is his optimism not matched by the members of the European Central Bank? Let's speak to Carsten Bredsky, Global Head of Macro Research at ING. Carsten, thank you so much for hanging on and listening to all of that.
Well, good afternoon, good evening. Very interesting.
Yeah, really interesting. Listen, Carsten, I want to have a really wide-ranging conversation with you about Europe's economy. And I want to start on inflation. And then let's talk about rates. But Eurozone inflation, it's fallen to 1.7%. It's the lowest in more than 3 years and below the ECB's target of 2%. Do you think this trend will continue, or could inflation rebound in the coming months?
I think inflation could rebound in the coming month, because this drop in inflation was mainly driven by lower energy prices. And remember, a couple of weeks ago, also in the UK, gasoline prices, oil prices had come down significantly, despite all the geopolitical tensions. Then after a couple of weeks with the tensions between Iran and Israel, oil prices went up again. And we will see that now with somewhat higher oil prices And also that the negative, what we call base effect, when you compare prices this year with the price of last year, there will be less of a negative factor on inflation. Plus, when you look at services price inflation, when you look at domestic inflation, when you look at selling price expectations by companies, it all still points to higher inflation. So I'm not talking about double-digit inflation, but we will see that towards the end of the year and also in 2025, we'll see inflation in the Eurozone moving again towards 2% and probably also above.
But what about countries like Germany? I mean, Germany is Europe's largest economy, and it really hasn't been doing very well. It's not growing. Would that feed into inflation, or in fact, you know, inflation not necessarily rising as high as people are looking for it to?
Yeah, correct. That could be one way. But what we're seeing in Germany and also in other countries, and you heard it actually from your interview partners across Europe. Wages are still increasing. Wages are still rising. So across the entire Eurozone, there is demographic change. There is a lack of qualified workers. And as long as the labor market appears to be stable, people will ask higher wages. So I think there is still more wage pressure coming up, which then also will feed into higher inflation. And we're fortunately not seeing yet the recession that would really justify a severe drop in inflation. However, a final point here on wages is that if we were to see that the problems in manufacturing, and we also heard it from the interviewed person in Croatia, that manufacturing is a big problem in Europe. If we were to see there the labor market turning, unemployment rising, this could then be the moment in which also inflation will come down further, because this would be the moment in which workers, employees will no longer ask for higher wages, but will rather opt for job security.
So because of that inflation rate, rather, the ECB just cut interest rates for the third time this year. I mean, is that an effective strategy? Do you think that is going to stimulate the economy, or is it going to be something else?
Well, it has to be something else. And of course, and this was a very good illustration. There is not one European economy. So the European economy is extremely diverse. And we do see that private consumption, tourism, beer consumption in the Baltics is still doing relatively well. While on the other hand, the manufacturing sector has been in problems already pre-pandemic. So a rate cut by 25 basis points will not make a difference. And the funny thing is that the ECB more or less explained to all of us today that they cut interest rates because inflation is lower, but everyone thinks this is not the right deal. I think everyone thinks that the ECB continued cutting interest rates because they are more concerned about growth. And but the 25 basis points rate cuts will not make a difference. Plus, the problem is, you know, when you look at the manufacturing sector, you could argue that the problems are structural. When you look at the German economy, you could argue the problems are structural. And there is very little that a rate cut by the ECB can do to solve structural problems. Or to be even blunter, these structural problems are all related to the rise of China and the changing role of China in the global economy. And no interest rate cut by the ECB can make Chinese products less competitive.
Yeah, I mean, that brings us on to growth, doesn't it? Because Eurozone is showing signs of slowing growth. I mean, do you see the region maybe entering a recession at some point? Or do you think these rate cuts or, you know, this possibly higher inflation might solve that?
Yeah, it's a different story now. And I think it doesn't really matter whether we're going to enter a recession or not, because we still think, when we talk about recession, we think in terms of one or two quarters of recession, of crisis, and then things will improve again and everything will be fine. What we're currently seeing is a different world, a different economic situation, especially in Europe. And that is one in which we are already in a kind of de facto stagnation. So it doesn't really matter whether the European economy grows by 0.5% or shrinks by 0.1%. We are stuck in this stagnation. I think also the interviews that you just showed it is not a sustainable growth model to just drink beer, buy wigs, and go on vacation in Portugal. So this is not what's going to earn European prosperity.
It might not, but it sounds good to me.
It also sounds good to me, in all honesty. give me a paper, I would sign it immediately. But this is where did you hear sustainable technologies? Where did you hear green transition? Where did you hear AI or digitalization?
Yeah.
These are all the sectors. These are all the factors that will really contribute and provide growth over the coming years. And that is what we're not having. So, long answer to your question, are we in a recession? Probably not. But we have to be prepared for a longer period of de facto stagnation.
Okay. Carson Bradsky, Global Head of Macro Research at ING, thank you so much for your time.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, The Documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Here with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, let's talk about water. It's a crucial natural resource for us all, but a report published by the Global Commission on the Economics of Water says that by 2050, more than half of the world's food production could be at risk and countries could lose up to 15% of their GDP. And that's especially true for lower income nations. Alison Wedgwood is the chief executive and founder of eWater Services. That's a private water operator in sub-Saharan Africa with operations in Kenya, Tanzania and Gambia. And I asked her what effects water scarcity is having on vulnerable populations and rural economies in Africa.
Right now, 411 million people in sub-Saharan Africa don't have access to clean water. So that's more than a decade ago. They are affected much more. I mean, I was only in a county a couple of weeks ago in Kenya where people are getting very, very sick. They're not accessing water. Girls aren't going to school. So all the sort of the things that you sort of saw in the 1980s and 90s are still happening right now in Africa. Mission 5 in this report talks about that no child dies from unsafe water by 2030. And we've got to sort of look at different models and put a lot more money in. It's going to be really tough unless there is a fundamentally different approach to the way that we are trying to improve water access for the very poorest in Africa.
Yeah, because there has been a lot of mismanagement, hasn't there, of water resources in Africa?
Yes.
That was highlighted in the report. I mean, what's your experience of that?
I mean, I would say it's one of the most mismanaged sectors. I've got to remember billions of dollars has already been spent installing water systems in Africa. And in every single village right now here in 2024, you'll find a broken water system. It is not necessarily about the volume of cash going into these economies. It's because of the mismanagement. I'm not just talking about corruption of that money. I'm on about the actual model itself has been very much led by donors, NGOs, being kind and giving money to programs and then working with the community. When they install a system, write their impact report and leave and hand over to the community, you know, quite a complicated borehole or, you know, a pump or some solar systems. And then a year later, they break. The approach has not been long-term enough and hasn't been professional enough. And so, right, I think just putting lots more money into it wouldn't be the solution right now.
The report also points to climate change, doesn't it? That it's degrading freshwater ecosystems too. I mean, how do you see that playing out in Africa where you've got water shortages and you've got extreme weather events? Have you seen them become a lot more frequent?
Yes. So we've had huge droughts in Lake Hippias, one of the counties we're just starting to work in. And then I was up there and we had huge floods and we couldn't even get out because the roads were flooded. So the frequency of extreme events is much worse. People are still burning water and cutting down trees essentially to boil water because there's been a lot more health education. So they're denuding the landscape and that makes it even worse. And so climate resilience is definitely where quite a lot of funding is going in and it is needed. But it again needs to be channeled in the right way to make sure that it has to be a long-term approach.
Alison, your company, you focus on providing sustainable access to clean water using technology. Tell me about those smart technologies that people can use to help address some of the systemic issues that the report outlines.
We have created a smart tap, which we can put them around the village. And the smart tap uses a mixture of NFC technology, near field communication. So people basically, they use their mobile phone money account, they charge up 5 or 10 cents onto their tag, and they touch the tap, which has a reader, and clean water is dispensed. And then using the Internet of Thing, the data goes into the cloud. So you're tracking the water flow and also the revenue. So it's completely accountable to everybody, you know, the government, the regulators. So it enables a complete robust way of collecting finance to pay for the operation and maintenance. I would say that the revolution in solar is also going to be groundbreaking, because solar pumping technology is much cheaper than it used to be.
It also hinted at maybe AI could be used as well. What would that look like, and what are your thoughts on that?
We're tracking, we are quite unique. We're tracking every single litre that is dispensed to every single tag holder in rural Africa. So we've got a huge, vast array of data of water usage, what's happening with flow rates. So we know if, you know, flow is gone, what's going on, is there a leak, where's the leak? And we can use machine learning now on our smart taps to maybe change the price of water to manage peak demand. So with the solar, if it's a cloudy day, we can try and spread demand out. We send text messages. We can use the AI to control how we manage the economics of water and also the technology of the water.
That was Alison Wedgwood, Chief Executive and Founder of eWater Services. Let's throw ahead to next week. Russian President Vladimir Putin will host the leaders of Brazil, India, China and South Africa in Kazan as the BRICS nations look to strengthen their economic and political ties. Together, BRICS countries represent about a third of the world's GDP and 40% of its population. And the group is growing. Countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Egypt are joining the ranks. But what does this expansion mean for the global economy and for those inside and outside the BRICS alliance? All of next week on World Business Report, we'll be diving into the future of BRICS and its impact on the world. So don't miss it, starting Monday. Let's talk to Walter Todd, President Chief Investment Officer at Greenwood Capital, who's joining us from South Carolina. Hello, Walter.
Hey, good evening from the US.
Good evening, absolutely. Thanks so much for joining us. A couple of stories that caught my eye. First up, US retail sales beating expectations, rising by 0.4% in September. What does that tell us, Walter, about the resilience of the American consumer?
Yeah, the American consumer is undefeated again. They continue to spend despite all the challenges and concerns that are out there. And, as you said, the 0.4%, but if you strip out a couple of things, it was 0.7. The expectation was for 0.3 and year over year up 3.6. However, when you kind of dig into it a little bit more, a lot of this was non-store retail, so online purchases as well as personal and health areas. So it maybe wasn't as strong as the headline would indicate. So for example, big ticket items, durable goods, those were much weaker. So I do think the consumer is being a little bit more cautious, even though the headline number was fairly strong.
Any risks of this momentum slowing down?
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll see. We've got obviously the election coming up. There's some, trepidation around, heading into that event. And then we have the holiday after that. So, but right now, the consumer continues to full steam ahead at this point.
Mm. Netflix just published its latest results. What are the headlines, Walter?
Yeah, so Netflix had a very strong quarter. They beat on top and bottom line. They added over 5 million subscribers. Their ad tier, which is a cheaper, less expensive tier, grew 35% in terms of new members. So they're really kind of firing on all cylinders. I think the stock was up 4 to 5% after hours. It's up over 40% year to date. So pretty strong showing from them.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's an interesting time for Netflix. It has huge subscriber base. It's gone through a password crackdown, hit record stock numbers in recent months. Yet is that enough for it to keep doing well? And what does its future look like? Lucia Moses is a senior correspondent at Business Insider who covers tech and media. And she's written a big and interesting piece on exactly that. You should check it out. Hello, Lucia.
Great to be here.
Yeah, Lucia, I mean, first question, is Netflix in good shape? Tell me.
Well, as you just went over, for sure, it is, undeniably won the streaming wars. It has got this giant subscriber base of upwards of, about 280 million people worldwide. and it's just got a towering lead over everybody else. So on the face of it, absolutely, you know, nobody would argue with that right now. It's doing very well. It's, you know, it's profitable. And yeah, it's sitting on a lot of cash.
Is there any one thing that it did to win that war?
Well, I think it got a very good head start in the streaming wars, and it built this huge library off of the TV shows and movies from other studios that didn't realize the, I guess, the threat and that Netflix would eventually become. And then they, I think they sort of regretted that decision to give them all their content. So by the time they tried to catch up, you know, it was just very hard when Netflix had such a huge lead, and their own economics were very shaky.
Mm. It still has a lot of challenges, though. It trails YouTube, for example, in terms of watch time. I mean, is that a problem for it?
It is something that they have referenced over and over on earnings calls, and people are increasingly starting to point out Netflix's share of the time people spend watching the big screen. Netflix's share of that has been stable, but YouTube's has grown. So it's nice that Netflix can share very strong time that people are spending watching its service. Is about it's an average of 2 hours per day. But you got to look at that in the big picture and see that others are growing and Netflix is holding its own. But people would you know wonder if it can grow that pie, and they certainly do want to. But they would point out that they are doing something very different from YouTube's of the world, right? They're not trading in, you know, user generated content. They are like a traditional Hollywood studio in that sense. They are, you know, fronting the money for the best premium content, best, you know, movies and shows in the world, and working with the, you know, top actors and directors.
Mm. YouTube is doing quite well with younger people, but Netflix isn't. I mean, how can they entice younger people onto that platform?
Yeah, that is also definitely a trend. Although Netflix did pick up some appeal with teens, according to a recent survey, but it is a challenge for them, and that I think comes down in part to you know, making sure they have TV shows and movies that appeal to every, you know, to young people as well as older people.
Mm. All right, Lucia Moses, senior correspondent at Business Insider. Last word to you, Walter. What's your favorite show on Netflix?
I'm kind of old school. I like the you know, I like the old movies from the 80s. That's when I grew up. And if they want younger people, they better take out this password sharing crackdown, because all the younger people were sharing the passwords with their parents.
That is very true. That is extremely true. Yeah, I have to admit, Walter, mine is Love is Blind. So it's my favorite one. Listen, Walter Todd, thank you so much for joining us. And that's it from World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Our producer is Olivia Wilson today. James Wickham is our editor. I'm Leanna Byrne. And don't forget, a podcast of this edition is always available by searching for BBC World Business Report. Thanks so much for listening, and tune in again very soon.
What does Hezbollah want? Why is Kenya getting involved in Haiti?
What can the world's biggest iceberg tell us?
The Inquiry. One big question.
Can we trust Google?
Four expert witnesses.
Time for our second expert witness.
And an answer.
What will be the solution?
Explore the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world with The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.